folks to check out the resources that will be on our website. Engage with, ours and other organizations that align with your values, and seek what resonates with you, and then take action, take the next step. It can be as simple as adding your name to a petition, or you can go the extra mile and submit your own unique comments to the agency. But it really does matter. I know that there are a lot of asks, and it feels like our attention is being drawn in so many different ways. But this is worthy of attention. It could have lasting impacts for so many of us.
Will have lasting impacts, absolutely. And one more time, that website is?
CaskWild.org, CASCWILD.org.
Grace, you've been so generous with your time. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for all your hard work. I have so much respect for the work you do. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks so much, Michael. I appreciate you having me on and all of your ongoing efforts.
That's it for this episode of Coast Range Radio. Once again, please take just a minute, share this show with your friends, give us a rating or review if you listen to us on a podcast app, and if you listen to us on your community radio station, tell them how much you appreciate them for what they do. As I said last week, those in power right now want us to feel hopeless and powerless and overwhelmed. Not giving in to that is an act of resistance. So keep your head up, take care of yourself, take care of others, and stay in the fight. Thank you so much for listening to Coast Range Radio. We'll be back next week.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The nominating committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio during this special programming campaign, All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 4. Now through April 15th, you will hear different marathons and series all brought to you by our talented programmers that make KBOO, KBOO. If you would like to listen to all of the fabulous specials, go to kboo.fm/ATNF4.
Good evening, you're listening to KBOO Community Radio here at 90.7 FM in Portland. Tonight is Transpositive, PDX. Tonight on Transpositive, we're going to be talking about the Scrimeti case, the landmark Supreme Court case under consideration right now, dealing with the issue of the rights of transgender youth to have gender-appropriate care. We'll be joined with Jasmine Wright, an attorney, and also Jean Bryant, our regular show host. And Jasmine, welcome to Transpositive. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I've been an attorney practicing for 19 years. I practice in mostly juvenile cases. I do juvenile dependencies and delinquencies. I've been transitioned for about 2.5 years. And I've connected. I'm on the Oregon's Public Defense Commission, where I was appointed by the Chief Justice. And I'm on several commissions and committees throughout the state, and I'm also part of the Trans Law Caucus, and connecting with other trans law attorneys and folks throughout the state on a regular basis to kind of talk about where we are and how we can do things to protect trans people in the state, and also kind of keeping an eye on things like the Scrimeti decision that even though they're happening in a red state, absolutely have the ability to affect us and what we're doing here. Well, in Scrimeti, of course, was a case out of Tennessee that was a fight mostly on the equal protection front. It had to do with transgender kids, and there was a ban in Tennessee that banned gender-affirming care for juveniles, essentially, both hormones and puberty blockers, but also surgeries as well. At the initial level of review, the district court agreed and gave this case heightened scrutiny. Then that went to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is broadly kind of thought at this point is a slightly liberal court. But surprisingly enough, on a 2-1 decision, the court made a determination that transgender rights were not, that it wasn't sex-based discrimination, and that it would just get normal review, which made it a lot easier to uphold the Tennessee law.
Excuse me, Jasmine.
Yep.
Before you progress,
yep.
you need to explain to our listeners what heightened scrutiny means. And I realize that we're starting down illegal, as briefly as you can.
So ordinary scrutiny would mean that the court only needs to make a determination that there's essentially it's the lowest level of scrutiny. Almost anything will fit under ordinary scrutiny. It's very easy for a state action to meet under the ordinary scrutiny. Under the heightened level of scrutiny, a state would have to prove that an action had a substantial nexus to a substantial interest. So, and then there's strict scrutiny, which is the highest level of scrutiny, typically only for race-based pieces of legislation. And it's very difficult for a law to be upheld when it is being evaluated under a strict scrutiny standard. So again, at the district court level, this decision was not upheld. The Tennessee law was invalidated because it was given that heightened scrutiny based on the idea that transgender students were discriminated based on their sex under an analysis of equal protections clause. When it went to the Sixth Circuit, it went back to ordinary scrutiny, and they said that it was that Tennessee's law essentially upheld that law, said it was okay. That set the standard for Scrimeti going to the Supreme Court. And we heard at the Supreme Court that essentially we know that we've got a 6-3 conservative edge here. What everyone wanted to see is what Neil Gorsuch was going to say. Neil Gorsuch was important because
he didn't say a damn thing.
Well, that's the issue, Gene, is that we wanted to know what he was going to say because he wrote the decision that upheld transgender workplace protections and actually did give transgender folks this elevated scrutiny that we sort of wanted them to have. So Gorsuch didn't, as Gene said, didn't say a damn thing. But the other justices who did talk gave us an idea of where the conservative ideas here were. And they seemed to believe that this should be they were willing to allow the Tennessee law to be upheld, and that they were essentially worried about getting involved in what they considered an evolving area of medical science. And they said, we're not equipped to do that. Now, that's particularly sort of ridiculous in light of the fact that the most analogous situation to this is probably the abortion rights and the abortion rights cases, where, of course, the court got in detail into medical science, and they got in detail in terms of, you know, viability and not viability in those decisions. As I was reading the oral arguments and the transcripts of them, I sort of thought the conservative justices were punting on that issue, and I thought, you know, can they read? Because the medical science and the medical recommendations from all of the American societies and medical places were very clear that they believe that this was medically necessary. What the conservative justices did, and I feel like they do this whenever they really need to get to a topic that they like, is they'll stumble over themselves doing something that they have before said that you shouldn't do. And here's what they did that they normally say that you shouldn't do. They took essentially social science data from Europe, from Great Britain and Sweden and other places, saying that the other countries were backing off of gender affirming care and saying that it wasn't unsafe. The reason that's sort of ludicrous is because historically, in conservative legal principles, that's been eschewed. The most well known person who essentially said that you absolutely shouldn't do that was Justice Scalia, but certainly Justice Thomas falls into that category ideologically. And it's unnecessary. It was unnecessary to go and look and see what is happening in Europe, because the American authorities were absolutely in lockstep that gender-affirming care for minors is medically necessary, that it's life-saving care. There wasn't any question one way or the other about that. So, yes, Jean.
If I may venture, that what the Supreme Court justices were doing were introducing conservative speaking points that had not a damn thing to do with real considerations, and marginally in terms of medical statistical considerations. Can you speak to that? Thank you very much.
Yeah, well, and that's what one of the justices, and I forget which one off the top of my head, reminded essentially the other justices, that as they sort of were delving into this, that this was a constitutional issue. But I think the one thing to kind of keep in mind here is the differences between red states and blue states in terms of what you can do in terms of your legal name and your gender marker. The reason that that's important is because the state of Tennessee was able to say this wasn't a legal protection argument, because in Tennessee, juveniles can functionally, at least from their legal documents, they can't change their gender marker. The only way you can change your gender in Tennessee is by going to a court and asking to get a court order. So they can make the argument in this case that, hey, this isn't an equal protection issue. This is just a healthcare issue that the state has a rational basis for making changes to and modifying as needed to protect the rights of these minors. That would be a different analysis in, for instance, our state, where we do have that ability. But I think, and one of the, you know, as we look for what this decision is ultimately going to be, one of the things that, and the reason I wanted to come on this podcast, is to essentially talk about what can we do in light of what we expect to be the Scrimeti decision, even if you do live in a blue state, to fully protect yourself. And I think one of the things that needs to happen is that even if you're in Oregon here, and the way that you have changed your legal status is through the designation on your birth certificate or some of the other ways that you can do that, I think that what you want to do right now is to get the highest and best way of changing your legal gender is by and through a court order. And your most protection would be by making sure that your legal gender has been changed by a court order. So I think that's really important, because the underpinnings of an equal protection argument require that there is a that there's a difference in treatment based on discrimination, based on sex-based discrimination. So, of course, in Tennessee, you can't change your. It's much more difficult to change your gender. Whereas,
yeah. and Jasmine, while I appreciate your response in the context of Oregon state circumstances, and arguably even within, you know, Washington state, probably even California state, you know, the West Coast state statutory, you know, circumstances. Right. I think the objective here in the discussion is the implications of what the potentialities are moving forward, you know, into the next few years. And I realize it's all, you know, throwing darts at the board.
There are some big implications. And the big implications here are because, again, it's under the equal protection guise, and certainly in light of the decision that essentially invalidated Roe versus Wade, you have an attack on both the equal protection clause and on the implicit right to privacy, which almost all of our major rights fall within that. So I think there is a concern. Absolutely, if you're a transgender child in a red state, you don't have the right to healthcare right now. If you are an adult, a transgender adult in a red state, I think you need to understand that your right to gender affirming care is likely on the block, because that has always been the goal, is to use the fight for juvenile access to transgender healthcare to get to adults. We have actual recording from legislatures that make that very clear, that that's always been the goal. So if you're an adult in a red state, you need to be concerned based on where we are. And if you're a queer person in a red state, you need to be concerned about your right to, if you're a member of the LGBTQ community, you need to be concerned about your right to get married. That the Obergefell decision is definitely under scrutiny at this point and on the chopping block based on what we've heard from the justices. So that's definitely a possibility, and that's why I think it was a little bit of a failure in the development of this case that more queer rights groups and women's rights groups were not filing amicuses on this case and were not actively a part of the lead up to this case, like the Obergefell case, because there was somehow not an understanding that what was going on here was going to have a system effect to everyone in the LGBTQ community. And what we're seeing right now with the justices seeming to want to say that the equal protection argument does not apply here does seem to have a chilling and systemic effect that could affect anyone in the queer community, and frankly, every woman. So the fight for equality in one area, in the transgender area, affects the entire spectrum. And we have to treat this like something that everyone cares about and everyone has their skin in.
Can you explain how to get a court order to change your gender? Because that would be a good thing for people to know. And the second question is, even if you do get a court order, how does that protect you when governors like Scott Walker decide to invalidate court orders of transgender people and automatically revert their gender markers back to whatever was?
Sure. So two issues. So getting the court order in Oregon actually is pretty easy. You can get onto the websites of most circuit courts. And you can file that motion pro se, that is without an attorney. You can literally write on there why you need the court order, and you can ask that the court change your name and your legal designation of gender at the same time. Typically, that is a probate matter, which means that you're not going to even go in front of a judge. And as soon as the judge sees it, they'll typically sign off on it. You don't need to provide documentation or proof that you're doing that. You just need to check a box. And then once you do that, you have changed your legal name and your designation of your gender, but you could do one or the other. So if you've already changed your gender, or I'm sorry, you've already changed your name, but you just want to change your gender, you could do that. And so that's that's certainly a possibility in terms of governors invalidating court orders. That is happening in Texas, and that's going to be something that attorneys in those states are going to have to put that fight in, because technically the governor doesn't have any rights to invalidate an order that a judge signs in that state than anyone else. But I'm not barred in Texas. I can't give legal advice in Texas. But my guess is that those actions are probably being judicially reviewed. I know that wouldn't fly in Oregon, but I kind of know what would happen if something like that did. But I want to underpin the fact that in these situations, when something like this, that's why, and one of the big points that I want to bring up is elections have consequences. They absolutely do.
And yeah, we weren't past that, honey.
Right. We are seeing the beginning steps of what this election's consequences are going to be. Okay. And what the previous election's consequences were to put these justices on the court that have an amazing ability to affect millions of people. And so, yes, we're past, Gene, you're right, we're past that point, but it's an underpinning of the fact that we as a queer and trans community have to be, we have to understand that this is our life and our livelihood at stake, and we have to be involved in our local elections, and we have to be involved in our state elections so that we can create a system that is as strong as we can for our trans community.
Amen. Thank you.
Thank you.
I do think one of the things that we don't want to lose track of, though, is this is only the second time transgender rights have been brought up before the court. The only other time was the decision that I referred to earlier that Justice Gorsuch actually signed off on giving transgender rights worker protections. But I think we want to kind of talk about the fact that Chase Strangio was the first openly transgender attorney to argue before the U.S. Supreme Court. So I'm also a member of the U.S. Supreme Court, so he's technically a colleague of mine, although he's argued one more case before the court than I ever have. As we usher ourselves in this new era, and there will be negative things that the Scarametti will definitely bring, I do want to bring light to the fact that we did have that historic moment where Chief Justice Roberts welcomed the first openly transgender attorney to argue before the court. Certainly will not be the last.
That is absolutely like a point of celebration that Chase was there. And, you know, I agree. That's an absolutely point of celebration.
I couldn't agree more. And in part of what I said before, I talked about the fact that this cause is a cause that all LGBTQ rights needs to embrace as one of their own, and that the struggle in one affects the other, and that it really has a systemic effect. And so Chase represented the ACLU, so the ACLU didn't file an amicus because they were an active participant in the case. But there were many other people, especially as you look at the Obergefell decision, everyone knew that decision was coming up, and there were hundreds of amicus briefs that were filed for and against it beforehand. There was none of that in this case. And I think that was a failure on behalf of our side in terms of not understanding the systemic effects that a decision like this could have and not bringing to the table the strongest case that we could have brought. Because now when we have this, whenever we get bad law, it takes twice as long, if not 10 times as long, to fix a bad law decision than to have stopped this from happening in the first place. So there will be downstream effects. There are certainly ways to deal with it. We'll have to be patient as we try to do that at the judicial level. But one of the reasons why I'm advocating getting a court order is because that will strengthen the ability of folks to, if you are legally the opposite gender that will strengthen the argument and the ability of potential plaintiffs to be able to make an equal protection argument and to argue that, that there's disparate effect based on your gender. Because if you are assigned male at birth and you get a court order change that to female, then there is a difference between how a biological male is treated under a certain law and how you would be treated once you get your gender legally changed. That's a stronger argument, and Tennessee would have had a harder time with that argument if the plaintiffs involved in this case would have legally been female.
Jasmine, please dial in on exactly the legal motions and court orders that you're advocating.
Okay. So what I'm advocating is that if you are, regardless of what kind of state you are in, red state or blue state, you need right now to get your legal gender changed via court order. That is the best and the strongest document that you can have, is the one that is most difficult. Yes, it's possible, is the most difficult to get overturned. And the more potential plaintiffs that we have that have that status will strengthen the ability for subsequent attacks on this and to hopefully get a decision from the court that finally addresses and says that an attack on transgender folks is a violation of the Equal Protection Clause.
So what does the Tennessee law mention about parental consent?
So in the Tennessee law, it doesn't mention parental consent at all. Essentially just says that it gives the state the ability to civilly fine doctors who are involved in any kind of gender affirming care on behalf of their patients. It allows them to affect them in that way, but it doesn't discuss parental consent at all. I do think that those could be winning arguments, but ultimately I think this is going to turn, and I think every major case as it has related to queer rights in the court has turned on the Equal Protection Clause, and I think this will ultimately also fall in that space. Whether or not the winning argument here hopefully is on our side, whether that argument also implicates the police state and the ability to parents to make decisions, which I think absolutely should be part of that. I'm not entirely certain, but you are absolutely right that this has been a very activist court, and very different than the court prior to this. Obviously, the Rehnquist court was very different from the Roberts court in lots of different ways. But there needs to be, in light of, I think you're right in terms of, I think there will be a blanket order from the court that will be very difficult to deal with. And I think that trans rights groups and queer rights groups need to have a conversation with themselves about this afterwards, about how we're going to deal with this and what the best way of attack for this is, because it is not it's not okay to sit on the sidelines and continue to watch this play out on the steps of the courthouse.
Okay, thanks. So I'd like to ask a couple of questions, but I had two questions regarding the questioning that went on from the justices during the Scrimeti case. One was, Justice Thomas was going for the legal age of consent. That seemed to be one of his opening questions. I mean, he seemed to make the point that these teenagers could simply choose what kind of medical care they want once they come of age. And so he was saying that this wasn't specifically an explicit prohibition against, you know, access to transgender medical care, but only medical care below a certain age. The other one was, I can't remember which justice it was. But one of the justices kind of went after the protected class issue and talked about how transgender people weren't historically a class that like would fall within protected class in the same way that race and and other categories have, you know, become categories that were protected class. And so I was wondering if you could address those two objections that the justices brought up that I thought were kind of, you know, interesting.
Yeah, so the class issue is sort of interesting because, again, Judge Gorsuch in the previous transgender case where the court signed off and gave workplace protections to transgender folks, gave transgender people the heightened scrutiny standard. And at that point said that there was an equal protection issue and that there was, and that transgender folks were discriminated on the basis of their sex. So not only do we have an instance in which the Supreme Court has previously made a determination that transgender people are in fact a separate sex, but also a determination that they have rights that can be protected. Now, the court has gone at length to say that that was only a discrimination, a workplace discrimination case, and it wasn't as it related to healthcare. So they're saying that it doesn't necessarily have precedential and binding effect to that. But we certainly do have an instance in which the court has done that. So I don't think the class argument, to be 1,000% honest, I don't expect that to be fully successful, especially because I think Justice Gorsuch is one of the most influential members of that conservative wing. And I don't think he can, I think it would be very difficult. He can, of course, but I think it would be very difficult for him to suggest in one case that transgender people are a member of the opposite sex and then to go back on that and say no. In terms of Justice Thomas's argument as it relates to age and the age of consent, I think that that was, this is kind of a sticky wicket issue for Justice Thomas. Both Justice Thomas and Justice Jackson have mixed race spouses. And one of the arguments that one of the justices brought up was, by attacking the underpinning of equal protection, does this possibly open the door for mixed race marriages to become invalidated? Could the Loving versus Virginia case, that's the bedrock of that, could that have been invalidated if Virginia just did a reclassification argument like Tennessee did here and said, oh, well, in that case, we're not making a law that's invalidating things on the basis of race. It's for another reason. So I think in Justice Thomas's instance here, as it relates to the age argument, you know, it's still a matter of a conservative justice stating here that the state has again, reinforcing the rational basis review and arguing that the state has the ability to prohibit those actions for a prescripted amount of time. And again, I'll go back to one of my previous points was that the actions of prohibiting gender-affirming care as it relates to juveniles was always a part of a long-term patient attempt by the conservative think tanks to attack adult transgender health and affirming care. So that's Thank always you. Been the goal.
Thank you.
And so that's the best answer that I can give, Emma.
So, Gene, and everyone, theoretically speaking, you know, what damage could be done? The government came after our health care. Like, what's theoretically could they do? And what could we do to protect ourselves? I mean, based on what we've seen so far, theoretically, what could happen?
The fact is that it's no longer theoretical. We have multiple years.
So Gene, here's one of the things that me and other members of the Trans Law Caucus are talking about is, you know, what can we do affirmatively to deal with this? Because one of the big concerns that we have and one of the things that Trump said on the campaign trail, it was a threat to put pressure on and sue the drug companies that create hormones that a lot of us depend on for our daily life. And so whereas the federal government doesn't have control over everything, of course, and they don't have control over certain drug distribution pipelines, if the federal government were to put significant efforts on drug manufacturers and affect, so right now lots of our estrogen and testosterone drugs are on back order because of supply chain issues anyway. If they were start getting sued by the federal government, that could put a huge strain on the ability of transgender folks to get the basic health care that they need. And for most transgender folks, HRT or hormone replacement therapy is the number one thing, the number one piece of health care that we rely on a daily basis to maintain both our physical and our mental health. So that's, you know, certainly going outside of the speculative, that's what we expect to happen. And that's something that's one of the things that I think trans folks, adult and juvenile alike, no matter where you're at, need to be concerned of, that's probably going to happen, is that your access to HRT drugs has a great likelihood of being curtailed.
What about the timing of the Scrimeti case? I mean, it just seems like this was a really bad time to introduce a case involving transgender rights. I mean, as we're heading into a conservative administration and there's a conservative majority and we pretty much know they're going to rule against us, I mean, doesn't it go against our interests right now?
Jasmine, what are you thinking of this? Because you knew it was a quagmire going in. I mean, you knew it.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. You did, girl.
But we don't get to pick the timing of these things, because it takes more than a year from the time that a case gets originally, and sometimes as much as 5 or 10 years from the time that it originally starts until the time that it eventually gets in front of the court. So we don't get to pick our timing, unfortunately. But, you know, I mean, my biggest takeaway of all of this is the point that I've been trying to make, which is that this is not just a trans issue. This is a queer issue. This is a women's issue, and that they are all interconnected, and that we need to, now that we are here, we're here at this point, and we pretty much know what Scrimeti is going to say one way or another. Now that we're here, we have to come together as a community to deal with this. And that means gay and lesbians and transgender folks and women need to all understand that this is a closed system, and we're all part of it. And one of the, you know, and right now what we have, one of the things we have to do is we're having to rely on other people to help us. Like right now in Oregon, we're trying to identify, you know, who are legislatures that are trans friendly. And one of the things that I've been kicking around, because I've been an attorney for the last 20 years dealing with kids and a lot of trans kids, is it time for there to be the first transgender politician in Oregon? Is it time for there to be somebody at the state house who actually understands gender health care as it relates to transgender people? Because right now there isn't. You know, is it time for there to be more advocacy from people that look and are us? You know, and so, you know, this podcast focuses on people who, activists and people who want to be involved in the solution. And I think certainly from a community interaction perspective, that's important, but it's also a discussion for those of us who are involved in government. You know, maybe this is the time where we need to be getting more involved. And maybe this is the time where we need to be advocating for our community at those highest levels, especially those of us that have the ear of you know, higher levels of government. Maybe it's time.
So here's a good question from one of our co-hosts. She asks, how does the case in Tennessee affect healthcare providers, people who provide healthcare and gender-affirming medical care, including hormones? How would this affect their ability to practice medicine?
Right now, the only thing they can do is they can civilly fine any doctor that's involved in obviously legitimate medical care. But if a black market were to come up with puberty blockers, obviously anyone who's doing that and isn't a licensed medical person is going to get in trouble for for operating without being a licensed medical provider. So they're going to have issues on that regard. But the statute itself is fairly silent. It essentially targets specifically medical providers to stop providing those. And it's important to note that most puberty blockers are not pills. Most puberty blockers are actually surgically inserted. And those puberty blockers, of course, can be taken out. So a lot of my kids, some of them, even if they get puberty blockers, will change their mind later, and they'll say, "Okay, well, maybe I changed my mind about that," and they'll have them removed. I guess. And my issue with the puberty blockers is there's really no harm, no foul with puberty blockers, whereas there's a great harm to my kids that have extreme gender dysphoria and they're not able to get puberty blockers, because certainly with male to female.
So Jasmine, Jean was just trying to ask a question, but I think there was a little problem with her audio. But I think I caught most of the question. She was trying to ask about statistically validated research and the problem that we have in the in the community of advocacy of funding for statistically validated research and for the issue of how they attack us with counterclaims, basically saying that the claims that we make aren't validated enough to make the claims we make. So what do you say to that?
No, I hear what you're saying, and I understand that. I acknowledge that it is a weakness in the argument that we don't have a, you know, like a double blind statistically set bit of data and statistics to support what we're trying to say. It'd be great if we did. But what we do have is essentially the sign off and agreement by every medical organization in the United States that both says that this is safe and effective and that it's medically necessary for these children. So, I mean, it's like in any situation, Gene, sometimes we don't have the perfect set of data for any case, but we have to take what we have. But does that mean we just leave it alone and ignore that weakness in our case? No. I think that there needs to be some, you know, we need to get some studies funded that are going to track, you know, how that works.
Amen, sister.
So what can we do to address the messaging about our trans lives in elections? I mean, how did the campaigning that the Republican Party did against transgender people affect us?
You know, just on the campaign trail, there was an analysis done, and so essentially, you know, $1,200 was spent on every transgender person if you break down all of the ads that were done. So, you know, to some degree, I suppose you can feel important that $1,200 was spent on each and every one of us too. But I think this court is particularly concerned, and Justice Roberts is concerned about looking like they are they're in the pocket of one or other politicians. And so Justice Roberts, I think, is trying to create this arrangement or this outward facing idea that the court is insulated from political influences. But I don't think that the other members of the court share that interest, because some of the members are highly political and highly conservative.
Why is Justice Roberts not, like, reining his court in? I mean, shouldn't he be acting like a leader right now?
Or the consensus builder that any of the previous chief justices were. And he's essentially, yeah, he's not able to develop a position and develop people to go to a particular side. He's essentially herding cats in the Supreme Court right now. And I don't even think he knows what he's doing, to be honest. And I've been watching the court for 25 to 30 years. And of all the justices that I have seen, I haven't seen a chief justice that was less ready to be in that role and has performed less well than Justice Roberts with what he's done. And before all of this was going on, I was actually always a conservative Republican before my transition. And so, you know, but I feel like, you know, they've made a Taylor Swift song that describes my relationship with the Republican Party, you know, that we're never, ever getting back together again. You know, so as being a previous conservative Republican, I think that this particular Chief Justice is completely ineffective in creating consensus and getting people on his side. I don't think he's even close to the most powerful member of this court.
So we had a question from a co-host who asked, who's filed an amici in this case? Where's the ABA on this? And after you've had a chance to say something about this, I want to comment on it.
You know, I didn't look up, at least in the Tennessee case, of everyone who filed an amicus in that case. But I know that there were not nearly as many amici in this case as there have been in some of the other more publicized cases. But I haven't, before this podcast, I did not look up specifically to see who filed amicus and who did not.
So I just want to say that we did a show about a month ago on Scrimeti. This is the second of three shows we're doing on Scrimeti. And we had a chance to interview Marissa Richmond. Marissa is a transgender woman of color from Tennessee who's very involved in organizing for the rights of transgender people in Tennessee, and has also been a four-time delegate to the Democratic National Convention. And she filed an amicus brief, and she spoke quite extensively about the various delegations that had filed, either had filed a brief or some of the strategy around Scrimeti. And that's actually why I opened this three-part series with Marissa. So if you want to take a look back, you can just go to the KBOO website, kboo.fm, and just look up Scrimeti, S-K-R-M-E-T-T-I, or just look up the show Transpositive, and you'll find that from about a month ago. Her name is Marissa Richmond, and she's just this amazing Black woman who is a transgender and has been a fantastic advocate for the transgender community for about 30 years in Tennessee. I think it's been about 30 years. Just tireless, and she's just retired from her position. She was a professor, I believe a professor of history, and just, you know, a dynamo. I hope she considers running for office someday, but that's just my personal opinion.
Ladies, as much as I would love to allow this discussion to keep going on and on and on, I want to give y'all a couple of minutes to breathe and just think about where this whole discussion has gone. And I mean, because it has crossed so many conceptual boundaries and a lot of things, but try to get it down to, I'm going to say like 30 seconds. Y'all go ahead. And I'm just going to let you launch when you want to launch.
Scrimeti is by far the most important case that the Supreme Court has ever looked at as it relates to transgender rights. I think that we are likely looking at a final decision that is going to negatively impact certainly juveniles, but certainly has the likelihood of negatively impacting all of us on a nationwide basis, no matter whether we're at a red state or at a blue state. So it is critical right now that we as a community come together, that we that we come together as a queer community, and that we analyze sort of what's important to us, and not only just as a queer community, but also that we come together with women, and that we coordinate with large organizations and other people that can sort of help us through this process. Scrimeti is the first step in the process that the court has seen as it relates to transgender rights. It will not be the last. So it's important that we are at the table every step of the way and that we continue to fight.
So what I'm hearing you say as a closeout is that this is not simply about trans. This is not a trans exclusive issue. This has multiple implications. Is that correct?
Absolutely. That is the takeaway.
Thank you. Ladies, thank you for your time tonight to discuss. Jasmine, thank you so much for your time.
No problem. Thank you so much for inviting me. Bye.
I'm one of the co-hosts of Transpositive, and I just want to take a few minutes here at the end of the show to talk about some resources and also just to let you know what's going on. There's so much happening right now in this country in the attack on transgender people. Just this morning in the news, I was reading about how the Pentagon intends to actually follow through on basically firing 12,000 transgender service members who many have spent decades in the U.S. military, and they're going to get fired and removed from their service specifically because they are transgender. And if you'd like to check out our show, we had 2 weeks ago, we had four transgender service members on, including Bree Fram. And they've written a book recently called With Valor and Honor, and it's a story of 47 transgender military service members. So if you have a chance, please check that out, because it's very contemporary to what's happening right now in our community. At the same time, in Montana, legislation was recently moved forward in the Montana State House that would criminalize transgender women using the bathroom and using changing rooms. Transgender women would be labeled as some kind of sexual offenders for using changing rooms. And there's laws that were passed. There's just so many. There's just been this avalanche of laws trying to take away transgender people's rights. And it's been hard to keep up with all this information. So I just wanted to let you know, if you're looking for a place right now to really go to get the most up-to-date information, I would suggest checking out the website Erin in the Morning. That's E-R-I-N in the Morning. Erin Reed. Erin, R-E-E-D, is a transgender journalist, and she's married to Zoe Zephyr, a Montana state legislator, who's also transgender. And Erin has the most up-to-date and really best written information about what's going on right now in the transgender community. So again, check that out. That's Erin in the Morning. I would also highly recommend going to Lambda Legal. Lambda Legal is a website. You can find them online. They also have a YouTube channel where they have a lot of workshops. They just had a really great workshop 2 days ago about passports, because transgender people are having problems right now with passports. They're getting passports back that don't have their correct gender identity. And they're also dealing with issues regarding state documents. So if your passport or your ID document has been changed against your will, I would encourage you to check out Lambda Legal and also just go there to get information on how to deal right now with issues regarding documentation. I would also check out the Transgender Legal Survivor, or I'm sorry, the Transgender Legal Guide. It's a guide that helps you to deal with information related to documentation. It's the Transgender Legal Survival Guide. And you can find that online. Just Google Transgender Legal Survival Guide. And those are all really great resources. Of course, there's so many places to go for care. There's lots of organizations, if you're in Portland, that support and service the transgender community, including the Equi Institute. If you're looking to get involved politically, I would definitely check out Basic Rights Oregon. And of course, write to your legislators. You know, Oregon is one of the states where transgender rights are protected. They're highly protected. And so write to your legislators and let them know how much you appreciate what they're doing. So, you know, these are our rights, and we need to preserve them. So we do need to get involved in the legislative process. We do need to make sure that we have people in place at the state legislature. So if you're thinking about running for office, please do. And thanks to our state legislators. Thanks to our public officials who are representing us. Thank you so much. You've been listening to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio. Thanks so much, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Transgender people don't live here.
I've never met anyone who's transgender.
I swear I don't know someone who's transgender.
Transgender and non-binary people like me hear this all the time.
But according to the HRC Foundation, there are more than 2 million transgender people in the United States.
We live in every community across this country.
You might be surprised to hear that there are more transgender and non-binary people in the United States than there are
Starbucks,
McDonald's, and Walmart locations combined.
In fact, if you put us all together,
there'd be more non-binary and transgender folks than the populations of DC,
or Nebraska,
or Maine,
or Idaho,
or West Virginia.
As a matter of fact, 15 states have a lower population than the amount of trans folks in the US.
So here are a few things to keep in mind.
You don't always know when a person is trans.
But we're your neighbors,
your coworkers,
your students,
your customers,
and even your friends and family.
We exist in every culture, todas las culturas, throughout human history.
And while we're more visible than ever before,
sometimes you just don't see us.
So when you hear about politicians pushing for discriminatory bills,
know this, these bills address problems that aren't even real.
Problems that don't actually exist.
But we do.
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 And we need your support.
walk in my sleep. What's up around me seems always free.
Hi, this is Emma. I am a co-host of Transpositive. At KABU, we prove every day that people-powered radio has the ability to bring us together across distances and give us hope when we feel despair. Your friends at KABU want to remind you that generosity has the same power. Join thousands of KABU supporters from all around the world, and let's rally together to build stronger communities. If you can, just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to this number 44321. And thanks so much for your support of KABU Community Radio. Bedroom surprise.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Calling all lovers of physical media. Join us at the KBOO station on Friday, March 7th from 6 to 9 p.m. for our monthly First Friday podcast.